Tonight's reading is taken from the book of John, chapter 7, verse 1 to 24. It can be found on the Church Bible's page 1076. After this, Jesus went about in Galilee. He would not go out about in Judea, because the Jews were seeking to kill him. Now the Jews' feast of booths was at hand. So his brother said to him, "Leave here and go to Judea, that your disciples also may see the works you are doing. For no one works in secret if he seeks to be known openly. If you do these things, show yourself to the world." For not even his brothers believed in him. Jesus said to them, "My time has not yet come, but your time is always here. The world cannot hate you, but it hates me because I testify about it that its works are evil. You go up to the feast. I am not going up to this feast, for my time has not yet fully come." After saying this, he remained in Galilee. But after his brothers had gone up to the feast, then he also went up, not publicly, but in private. The Jews were looking for him at the feast and saying, "Where is he?" And there was much muttering about him among the people. While some said, "He is a good man," others said, "No, he's leading the people astray." Yet, for fear of the Jews, no one speak openly of him. About the middle of the feast, Jesus went up into the temple and began teaching. The Jews therefore marveled, saying, "How is it that this man has learning when he has never studied?" So Jesus answered them, "My teaching is not mine, but his who sent me. If anyone's will is to do God's will, he will know whether the teaching is from God or whether I am speaking on my own authority. The one who speaks on his own authority seeks his own glory. But the one who seeks the glory of him who sent him is true, and in him there is no falsehood. Has not Moses given you the law? Yet none of you keeps the law. Why do you seek to kill me?" The crowd answered, "You have a demon. Who is seeking to kill you?" Jesus answered them, "I did one deed, and you all marvel at it. Moses gave you circumcision, not that it is from Moses, but from the fathers, and you circumcise a man on the Sabbath. If on the Sabbath a man receives circumcision, so that the law of Moses may not be broken, are you angry with me, because on the Sabbath I made a man's whole body well? Do not judge by appearance, but judge with the right judgment."
Thank you, Marcus. Thank you, Kenny. I guess most of us will be aware, I hope you are, that we've just had a mayoral election. We've got a newly reappointed mayor, Boris Johnson. And he wrote once in his column in the Daily Telegraph, he said, "My faith is a little bit like Magic FM in the Chilterns, in that the signal comes and goes." It was got quite widely reported, and it's quite an evocative image, isn't it? So I think it's actually the experience of lots of people, that they say that the signal in their faith comes and goes. Some days they wake up and faith in God seems perfectly obvious. Other days and they wake up and they're not sure God is there at all, and they just wonder if it was all wishful thinking. And then perhaps on top of all of that, we wonder sometimes, I guess, whether what we have really is genuine faith. I wonder if you've ever had that thought. Is what I've got the real McCoy? Now, if you've got one of these white sheets, you'll see at the top there, we've just started a little series called Dealing with Doubt, looking at John chapter 6 to 8 together. And today we're thinking about this issue I've put there on the sheets. How can we have true spiritual certainty? Is it possible for us to have true certainty about God, about our standing before God? And if so, how do we get that kind of certainty and how do we keep it? And I take it wherever we might be on this whole spectrum of unbelief to belief, this is a crucial question for each one of us. So I was speaking to someone recently who's not yet a Christian. He's been looking into the Christian faith from the outside, and he feels like, he'd say he now has a good grasp of what the Christian message is and what is at stake. But he said to me, "But really, it's taking a punt, isn't it?" He said. "So after all, we can never really know for sure whether it all actually happened, can we?" And maybe that is your experience. You're looking in on the outside and you share that same concern. Can I actually be sure about it? Or even if we've been believers for decades, I take it that the key to our day-to-day spiritual energy and vitality is closely linked to our assurance. So if I'm feeling today a little bit shaky about God, about whether he really knows me, loves me, cares for me, I take it that my spiritual energy will be at best half-hearted. So whoever we are on this kind of spectrum, we need to know how can we keep true spiritual certainty? Now, when we are having doubts, some people assume that the key issue is what we know. You can't believe in Jesus, can you, unless you know something about him. So why not go and read the accounts of his life, go and pick up a book examining the evidence for the resurrection. Other people tell us that the key issue is God's help. So you can't believe unless God helps you. So why don't you pray to him, ask him to open your eyes. And actually, I think those are two brilliant bits of advice, aren't they? Getting into the Bible and asking for God's help. So they're both brilliant things for us to do when we're facing doubts, when we are seeking spiritual certainty. But it's interesting to me that the key factor for gaining true spiritual certainty, which Jesus highlights in our passage today, it comes down to a rather different issue. And that is the question of what it is we're seeking. So our first point here on the sheets, I put here, if we seek the world's approval, we will be unable to truly believe. So let's get into this passage together. If you were here last week, we were looking at the end of chapter 6, and you'll know that when we're looking at that, things were not looking very positive for Jesus. So that chapter started with huge crowds following Jesus. By the time we got to the end of the chapter, there were only a handful of disciples who were still loyal. And then our section begins, verse 1 of chapter 7. It says, after this, so linking with the previous chapter, after this, Jesus went about in Galilee. He would not go about in Judea because the Jews were seeking to kill him. So we see that things are at a pretty low ebb for Jesus. Jesus hasn't just lost his following. He's also here under threat for his life. And it's into this situation that Jesus' brothers come to the rescue. And they offer some advice to help get things back on course. So verse 2, now the Jews' feast of booths was at hand. So his brothers said to him, leave here and go to Judea, that your disciples also may see the works you are doing. For no one works in secret if he seeks to be known openly. If you do these things, show yourself to the world. They're saying, Jesus, if you really want some recognition, what you should do is take your miracles to that region where the capital is, around Jerusalem. And if you want to make it big, that is the place you've got to be. Which sounds, doesn't it, like pretty sensible advice. But then verse 5 comes as a bit of a shock. Verse 5, for not even his brothers believed in him. That is an odd verse, isn't it? A shocking verse. We've just heard that Jesus's brothers, they believe Jesus' miracles are real. They're totally pro-Jesus. They want his success. They're trying to encourage it. And yet verse 5 tells us that they don't truly believe. Their faith isn't real faith. And the following verses explain what the issue is. Verse 6, Jesus said to them, my time has not yet come, but your time is always here. The world cannot hate you. It hates me because I testify about it that its works are evil. You go up to the feast. I'm not going up to this feast, for my time has not yet fully come. Now, the issue here is what is really behind the brothers' advice to Jesus in verse 3 to 4, and that is that it's the desire for the world's approval. But Jesus explains to them in 6 to 8 that that is a real problem. So Jesus, in these verses, he's explaining that there are basically two camps that we can side with in life. There's the world and there's Jesus. And the point is, Jesus says in verse 7, that the world hates Jesus. And he says they hate him because, he says, I testify about it that its works are evil. Now, we've already seen, as we've been looking through this gospel, that Jesus' message is that he is the Savior. He says that he has come from outside of this world into this world to rescue human beings from being under God's judgment. And the implication of this message for each of us is not very flattering. I don't know if you've actually had this experience, but it'd be the equivalent of when somebody buys you breath freshener for Christmas. It does imply that there's something wrong with us. So Jesus' message declares to each one of us here that we're not quite as impressive as we thought we were. In fact, without Jesus, we're in real trouble. And Jesus is aware that this message is inevitably going to mean that Jesus is going to be hated. Because people, and I guess we'll have discovered this about human beings by now, but people hate having their faults exposed. We hate it. And all of this explains why it is that the brothers are unable to truly believe in Jesus. You see, truly believing in Jesus means changing camps. It means switching over to being hated by this world. But you see, at heart, the brothers here are driven by a desire for this world's approval. And so while ever that is true, they will be unable to cross over, change camp, and to truly believe. And if we seek the world's approval, as I've put there as the heading, we will be unable to truly believe. I guess all of us will have seen the effects of peer pressure in various contexts. The obvious example I think of is the kids at the back of the class who are more interested in showing off to their mates than they are in doing what the teacher wants. Or perhaps more recently, you might have seen it in a professional context where the people in a particular team are more focused on boosting their own image than in following the team leader's strategy. And I guess we've all seen how destructive that tendency can be. But when this dynamic happens on a spiritual level, it is absolutely deadly. It is toxic. C.S. Lewis put it like this. He said, "I believe that in all men's lives at certain periods, one of the most dominant elements is the desire to be inside the local ring and the terror of being left outside. Of all the passions, the passion for the inner ring is most skillful in making a man who is not yet a very bad man do very bad things." And this inclination that C.S. Lewis and John the writer is pointing us to, it affects each one of us. So our default setting is to be more interested in the opinion of those around us than we are in our Creator, the one who made us. And this tendency has so infected us that it makes us spiritually blind and we're unable to think clearly or to believe rightly. I think for me, what is most frightening in these verses is just how subtle this problem is. So it's a diagnosis that we might not even be aware of. If you'd asked Jesus' brothers if they believed in him, I'm pretty sure they would have said, "Of course we do, of course we do. We've seen his miracles, we're fully behind him." But then verse 5 tells us they don't truly believe. Now in verse 1, we found a different group of people, the Jewish leaders in Judea, who are trying to kill Jesus. And we're going to learn more about them as the chapter progresses. Now their response to Jesus, that is pretty obviously unbelief, isn't it? It's a straightforward, murderous hatred of Jesus. But what these verses show is that unbelief can come in more than one outfit. So one group in these verses, the leaders, are anti-Jesus. They feel threatened by Jesus' miracles and they want them stopped. The other group, the brothers, are pro-Jesus. They're excited about his miracles and they want them to be more public. But despite these two different sets of symptoms, what characterizes these two groups is the same disease. Both groups have the same thing at the root of what it is that gives them their joy, what gives them their satisfaction in life. And that is human approval. So for the brothers, they're pursuing human approval through promoting Jesus. I guess they want to receive a bit of reflected glory, don't they, off the back of Jesus' success. For the leaders, they're pursuing human approval through opposing Jesus. So they want to protect their power base by getting rid of Jesus. But for both groups, it's the love of the world's approval that makes them unable to truly believe. And so For each one of us in this room today, and wherever we might be on that kind of spectrum, anti-Jesus to pro-Jesus, this passage asks each one of us, is what is really driving me human affirmation, worldly approval? So if we're anti-Jesus, is it possible that our resistance to Jesus and to his claims is actually being driven by the fear of what others might think? Perhaps you fear professional or social disapproval if you were to become a Christian. I had a friend at uni who looked into Christian things, and at the end of it all, she told me that she simply couldn't believe it. And I probed a little bit, and the reason that she gave, and I think she was pretty honest and pretty self-aware in what she said, but she said that becoming a Christian would effectively be announcing to a whole family that they were wrong about their lives and about their priorities. And that was something she just couldn't do, and she wouldn't do. Now, for those of us in this room who are pro-Jesus, we're signed up followers of Jesus, like I guess these brothers were. The question for us, if someone examined our lives in detail, and if they, you know, if they had total access to everything we did, and they put it under scrutiny, and they looked at our big life decisions, they looked at the little decisions we make day by day, would they conclude that we are ultimately being driven by God's approval or by human approval? So can we even think of the last time that we acted in a way that had some cost, perhaps to our reputations, perhaps to our advancements, simply because of our greater loyalty to God and our greater love for him? Because if not, there is every chance that we are a bit like these brothers are in these verses, and that this addiction to human approval is actually holding us back from true belief and true relationship with God. And it's only then, when we come to a real relationship with the living God, that we will experience true spiritual certainty, that warm assurance which true relationship with God brings. It's what the Bible describes elsewhere as the Spirit, that is God himself, testifying with our spirit that we are children of God. That is a wonderful thing when somebody truly believes. So I hope we've seen these opening verses hold out a warning to us, don't they, about seeking the wrong things. And then in the next section, Jesus holds out the promise positively, and I've put there that if we seek God's will, we will have true spiritual certainty. So back in verse 8, Jesus had made it clear, hadn't he, that he wouldn't go up to Jerusalem in the way his brothers want him to go. He wouldn't go with a fanfare and a grand entrance. But in verse 10, he does decide to go to the feast, but he decides to go under the radar. Now, last time Jesus was in Jerusalem, that's the capital city, was back in chapter 5, and he healed a guy who had been paralyzed for 38 years. And Jesus then, off the back of that, made the claim that he was equal with God. And so when Jesus gets to Jerusalem on this trip, he is the one that everyone is talking about. But despite Jesus' clear miracles, despite his clear claim to be God, there's a lot of spiritual confusion surrounding him. So let's pick it up from verse 12. And there was much muttering about Jesus among the people. While some said, he's a good man, others said, no, he's leading the people astray. Yet for fear of the Jews, no one spoke openly of him. And then in the midst of all of this spiritual confusion, different ideas about who Jesus is, Jesus cuts through it all and he declares that there is a way through this confusion. There is a way to have true spiritual certainty. So verse 16, so Jesus answered them, my teaching is not mine, but his who sent me. I.e., this is divine teaching. It's not merely human. And verse 17, if anyone's will is to do God's will, he will know whether the teaching is from God or whether I am speaking on my own authority. So Jesus is saying, if we don't want to just take a punt, as that person said at the beginning, or if we don't just want to have a signal that comes and goes, as Boris Johnson put it, if we want to have true spiritual certainty, to know for sure whether Jesus' claims are really true, Jesus says that there is a way to be sure. And what is that way? What is that way? Verse 17. It is to do God's will. It is to start living in humble obedience to God. Now Jesus describes in verse 18 that the proof that he is trustworthy is his concern for God's glory. Verse 18, the one who speaks on his own authority seeks his own glory, but the one who seeks the glory of him who sent him is true, and in him there is no falsehood. So Jesus is tuned into God and his glory. And that is why, as soon as we are tuned into God and living for him and doing God's will, we're suddenly on the same wavelength, the same channel, and we're then able to recognize Jesus loud and clear, and we're able to have certainty about him. Now, this is radical teaching. Some of us here are just struggling to take it in. Jesus is turning upside down, isn't he? How we tend to think human beings work. To many of us, this sounds back to front, doesn't it? So our natural assumption is that we are neutral, and that basically we sit in the judge's chair, we examine the evidence for God, and then when we're sure, we make our judgment on that question. But if you think about it, if there is a God who made this whole universe, a God who made you and me, then you and I are not going to be able to figure him out with our little brains, are we? I mean, how could Sherlock Holmes investigate the evidence of his creator, Sir Arthur Conan Doyle? We don't rely on Stephen Hawking's cleverness to work out the truth about God. No, for human beings to know our creator, he must reveal himself to us. And God chooses not to reveal himself to the cleverest and to the most knowledgeable necessarily, but to the humble and to the submissive. Not to those proudly sitting in the judge's chair and summoning God into the dock, but to those who are humbly responding to the revelation which God has already provided, which is all around us, and then who are prepared to humbly do his will, whatever that might mean for us. So if we're in this room and we've already made up our mind that we don't like some aspect of God's teaching in the Bible, and there's no way that I could submit to God on that issue, then whatever that is the case, I will never be able to think clearly or to have spiritual certainty. And I think this principle is very helpful for us to get clear on, partly for ourselves, because it does help the way we ourselves deal with doubts and uncertainty in ourselves, what we do about it. But it's also helpful for us in thinking through for how we might be talking to other people about Jesus. So there often comes a point in conversation, you might have had this experience, where a person has heard the gospel, they've heard about Jesus. It becomes increasingly clear as we talk to them now that just more and more objections keep being thrown up. And it doesn't seem to be that they're interested. It seems like the objections are just ways of avoiding the issue, rather than real issues. And I think if that happens, it can be a great help to people to help them understand what exactly is going on in them spiritually. So you could put it like this. You could say, I may be wrong here, but I get the impression in the way we're talking that at some level, you don't really want this to be true. I mean, I might have got that wrong, but would you say that is fair? Is that possible? Or you could say, you know, what would you say that God would have to do in your life to persuade you? Or would you say that your mind is basically already made up on this? And just by certain questions, you might help someone to get a sense of their own bias, their own heart attitude, which can be a great help to someone encouraging them to humbly look at Jesus, not from the judge's seat, but coming humbly to God. Or you could tell someone about this verse. I think this is a great verse to go to, the theme verse that we've had. And kind of encourage them to see that there is such thing as a spiritual certainty, verse 18, to those who really want it. Now, for those of us, I guess there will be some here who are wondering how these final verses, is it 19 to 24, how they fit into what Jesus is teaching here. So let me just spend a few moments to make a comment about them. The people that Jesus is speaking to in this crowd, when they hear Jesus speaking about doing God's will, they would immediately think of the law of God, the law of Moses. That's what it is to do God's will. And previously, they've accused Jesus of being a lawbreaker because he healed a man on the Sabbath, which is the day when God had commanded people not to work. But then in 19 to 24, Jesus goes on to show that they and not he are the real lawbreakers. So it's their refusal to do God's will, and it's actually demonstrated by their determination to kill him. That is what is causing them to have this spiritual confusion and to make wrong judgments. So the reason there's so much spiritual confusion surrounding Jesus is not because the evidence isn't compelling, but Jesus says it's because the people, despite their religious zeal, are not truly seeking God's will, and that's why they're not seeing clearly on this issue. So I hope that gives us a way in as we look at those verses. But as we close, I just want to give a couple of modern contemporary illustrations of this whole principle that we're looking at so we can get a grasp of how it works its way out. Now, the first example I want to give of this connection between our wills and our spiritual certainty comes from the actor Brad Pitt. I don't know if you know this. Brad Pitt was raised as a Christian. He was a Southern Baptist. And for a little while, he said it made sense to him. So he said one time in an interview, religion works. I know there's comfort there, a crash pad. It's something to explain the world and tell you there's something bigger than you and it's going to be all right in the end. It works because it's comforting. I grew up believing in it and it worked for me in whatever my little personal high school crisis was, but it didn't last for me. And then inevitably the interviewer goes on to ask, well, why not? And fascinatingly, Pitt, he then points to a clash of personalities, a clash of wills between him and God. He said this, I didn't understand this idea of a God who says, you have to acknowledge me. You have to say that I'm the best. It made no sense to me. I think this is a very honest and also a very revealing quote from Brad Pitt. So despite his upbringing, he says that Christianity makes no sense to him. It's perplexing, it's confusing. And why is that? Well, according to this quote, it's because he doesn't like the idea of a God who says, you have to acknowledge me. Now, Jesus says that spiritual certainty only comes to us when we acknowledge that God is God and when we put his will before our own. And until we do that, it will remain a confusing mystery to us. But let me finish with a more positive example of this connection between our wills and our spiritual certainty. This one comes from the writer Becca Pippert. Becca Pippert is actually the face that you see when you look at that board as you come in. She's the speaker on the Women's Convention this autumn. She's written a bunch of books, one of them, Out of the Salt Shaker. She tells the story of one student, Sue. And Sue was looking into the gospel, but she didn't yet believe in Jesus. And Sue was pointed to this very verse. I said verse 18 earlier, verse 17. And she decided to give it a go. A little while later, Sue wrote this. She said, one day I read in the Bible, if someone steals your coat, don't let him have only that, but offer your cloak as well. For whatever reason, that verse hit me between the eyes. So I said to the four walls, listen, walls, or God, if you're there, I'm going to do what this verse says if the opportunity arises today. I want to remind you that I'm trying to do things your way to find out if you exist and if Jesus really is who he says. Amen. Then, she said, I headed to the library to continue working on my thesis. Just as I sat down at my designated desk, this guy comes up and tries to steal it. We have a big argument, and in the end he said, look, I'm stealing it from you whether you like it or not. And it suddenly hit me. I couldn't escape the fact that I'd read that verse. I took a deep breath, I tried not to swear, and I said, okay, you can have the desk. A little while later, he asked me why I let him. I told him that in order to know if Jesus was really the way to God, I was attempting to obey the things that he told us to do. And today I read that if someone tried to rip me off, I was supposed to let them. He asked, why in the world would Jesus say such a senseless thing? And I said, hey, if there's one thing I have learned from reading about Jesus and meeting these Christians, it's that Jesus would give you a whole lot more than a desk if you'd let him. And as I said those words, I just simply knew it was all true. I knew it from the inside out. I sort of felt as if God was saying, well done. That is the way I want my children to behave. And so I hope we see that wherever we might be today on this spectrum I'm talking about, doubt to faith, Jesus promises in this verse this wonderful assurance, internal assurance, to any one of us who will determine to put God's will first.